Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
I'm Brian Lehrer. This is my Daily Politics Podcast from WNYC Studios. It's Wednesday, March 23rd. And let's dive right in because we're very happy to have today former U.S. Ambassador to Ukraine, William Taylor. As many of you will remember, he became a public figure in 2019 during the first Donald Trump impeachment hearings when Taylor testified that Trump had been pressuring President Zelensky with a collection of policy threats and offers to get Zelensky to announce investigations into Joe Biden and whether Ukraine interfered in the 2016 election in support of Hillary Clinton rather than Russia in support of Trump. But there was much more to Taylor's career than that. He graduated from West Point and served in the Vietnam War, where he earned a Bronze Star and other medals. He played a leadership role in the 1990s in U.S. assistance to Afghanistan and Afghan refugees after the Soviet occupation there ended. He was the first director of the Iraq Reconstruction Management Office for President George W. Bush in 2004 and 2005 after the U.S. invasion there. Under President Obama, he oversaw U.S. assistance to some key Arab nations during the Arab Spring. He did his first stint as ambassador to Ukraine for President Bush starting in 2006 and was back again as U.S. chargé d'affaires under Trump, and I could go on. He's now vice president for Russia and Europe at the U.S. Institute of Peace. And in recent appearances at Texas A&M University and elsewhere, he laid out three scenarios for how the war in Ukraine might end. We'll hear them. Ambassador Taylor, we really appreciate that you're joining us today. Welcome to WNYC.
Brian, it's great to be here. Thank you very much for having me.
First of all, how surprised are you that Putin didn't just try to seize the Donbass region in eastern Ukraine that has the Russian separatist movement, but instead is trying to take the entire country?
Right, Brian. So he effectively already controlled that part. This is a very good reminder that this war that Russia is fighting, is imposing on Ukraine, totally unjustified, totally unprovoked, began in 2014. We remember that that Putin invaded Ukraine, first in Crimea and then in Donbass, in answer to your question, again, totally unprovoked. And so this war has been going on for 8 years, nine coming on nine, and it is a grinding war. 14,000, before this war in February started, Brian, 14,000 Ukrainians had been killed. So Putin already owned, in some real sense, that portion of that he'd occupied. The Ukrainians never agreed. The Ukrainians always maintained and still maintain that the territorial integrity, that the internationally recognized borders of Ukraine include Donbass and Crimea. And they're continuing to fight that.
What's your impression from your long experience in Ukraine about how divided the people of the Donbass region are between people who want to remain part of Ukraine and people who want autonomy or want to be part of Russia? And similarly, in Crimea, where Putin, of course, annexed that area in 2014, but there doesn't seem to be the resistance movement, from what I've read, that there would be in the rest of Ukraine if he occupies the whole country.
Brian, you're exactly right. There's a real difference between the parts of Ukraine, that is Crimea and the occupied part of Donbass, in terms of the attitudes of people who live there, compared to the attitudes of Ukrainians who live outside of those areas. And outside of those areas, including, so we have to remember that in Donbass, there are two oblasts. There are two kind of states, if you will. One is called Donetsk and the other is Luhansk. And the Russians occupy part of Luhansk and part of Donetsk. And that together is called Donbass. So he occupies part of Donbass. And in the occupied part, because they've been living under occupation and under control of the Russians, this applies to Crimea as well, they have heard nothing but the Russian version of this story. They have been told over and over that the government in Ukraine is not a legitimate government. It's made up of, they even call them fascists and neo-Nazis. And so the people, again, the Ukrainians who are living under occupation have heard this for 8 years. And you know, they can be forgiven for expressing those views. That in contrast, Brian, to all of the Ukrainians who live outside, even the Ukrainians who live in the unoccupied parts of Donetsk and Luhansk, they, like the rest of Ukraine, are united in their opposition to Putin. And they're united in their opposition to this unprovoked invasion, this aggression. And the Ukrainian people, including those people in unoccupied Donbas, including the rest of the nation, are totally focused on their own independence. And they, as we see, Brian, they are heroically fighting for that independence.
So you're talking about Russian propaganda and successful brainwashing, basically, in areas of the country that they control. But I'm curious for you as a diplomat, and diplomats do negotiation, if you see a negotiated solution as either possible or acceptable to end the ongoing atrocity of the slaughter of civilians around Ukraine. I've read scenarios written by people who are not apologists for Putin that suggest perhaps an autonomy vote in the Donbass, those regions that you described, recognizing the Russian annexation of Crimea, where there doesn't seem to be a resistance, and Ukraine wouldn't join NATO but could form independent alliances with the U.S. or other NATO nations individually. Do you think Ukraine would or should go for something like that?
Well, the right question is would, because this is a decision for the Ukrainians in the first instance. And President Zelensky has done a brilliant job of leading his nation, and he is representing the views of Ukrainians who will answer exactly that question that you just posed. And I know, we all know, President Zelensky has said that he's looking in the first instance for ways to stop this war. Clearly, he wants to stop this killing and destruction that the Russians are pouring down on cities across the country. So sure, President Zelensky wants to stop that. He's been proposing negotiations for as long as it started. He said just recently he's been proposing these negotiations for 2 years. So sure, there is a possibility for negotiations. And these negotiations on the Ukrainian side have to be led by the Ukrainians. That is, all of these proposals that some people are making are useful and interesting, but are not going to be in effect. They're not going to be actual until President Zelensky decides this is where he wants to go. And so in answer to your question, Brian, President Zelensky has said that he's looking to secure his country. He wants to provide security for Ukrainians across the nation, across the Ukrainian nation, including the occupied territories eventually. So he's looking for how to secure them, how to provide that security. He had thought that NATO would provide that security. And he had thought, because he'd been told, that at some point Ukraine would join NATO. As we know, the NATO leaders in 2008 said that Ukraine would someday, they didn't say when, someday join NATO. Well, President Zelensky has concluded now, recently, that that's just not going to happen in time. President Zelensky wants to be able to provide security to his people now. And he realizes now that that's not going to be NATO. NATO is not going to be the answer in the near term. So he still wants to provide security, and he's looking for other ways to do that. And you're right. He has been thinking about other options, and it might be outside of NATO. It might be there are models, Brian, in Europe today that might be attractive. For example, Austria. As a member of the European Union, not a member of NATO, it has the ability to defend itself, has the ability to make its own decisions. It's autonomous. It's sovereign. It's recognized within its borders. That's not a bad model for President Zelensky if he's interested. I just want to emphasize the point that we can all talk about this and others can make suggestions, but in the end, the decision for negotiations and what goes in those negotiations has to be President Zelensky's, his team, and the Ukrainians. So questions that you rightly raised, Brian, that is, what would be the status of Crimea? What would be the status of occupied Donbas? What would be the status of weapons that would be from other nations, from like the United States or NATO? These decisions are important decisions, and they will be made in the first instance by the Ukrainians. And what my view is that we should support President Zelensky in those negotiations. He's eager to have negotiations. The Russians haven't been. Russians have delayed, have stalled, have said, mm-hmm. Oh, it's not the right time. They've sent people to these negotiations that are not empowered to make any decisions or even make suggestions on these negotiations. So the Russians are not there. The Ukrainians have been. They've been serious. They've sent serious people to these negotiations. The Russians haven't. But the short answer to your question is, yes, it is possible that negotiations will end this war.
Do you have a sense then of the Ukrainian people in the western parts of the country and how much appetite they have for continuing to suffer these atrocities, these war crimes, really, against civilians in pursuit of territorial integrity involving the Donbass or even Crimea? Are the people of Kyiv, are the people of Lviv, are the people of Ivano-Frankivsk willing to keep being slaughtered as complete innocent civilians in this conflict for the sake of territorial integrity in the East, or more willing to make a compromise? Because, of course, as you say, it's not up to us, it's up to them. But, you know, we all feel so bad about what's taking place there.
We feel horrible about what's taking place there. We feel angry about what's taking place there. We can't believe that in this time, in 2022, there's a monster in Moscow that's exactly what you say, that is killing civilians day after day, intentionally shelling apartment buildings, hospitals, schools. It's appalling. That these war crimes, as you rightly call them, these are war crimes. It's appalling that these continue today. And then you ask, are the Ukrainians willing to fight? And the answer, Brian, is yes. And it's not just those in Lviv, in the Western. It's not just those in Kyiv, in the central. It is across the country. Of course they hate the killing. And of course they want it to stop. And of course they want President Putin to stop the killing and withdraw his forces. They want the Russians to go home. They say that over and over. Even in the cities, Brian, like in Kherson, one of the few major cities, not even a major city, one of the few cities of any size where the Russians occupy, the citizens of Kherson go out every day in opposition to the occupiers. And they yell at them, go home, go home.
And risk their lives in doing so.
They are willing to fight.
Colonel Alexander Vindman was on the show last week, who, of course, was another witness in the Ukraine-related Trump impeachment hearings. And he was suggesting, I hope I'm not misquoting him, that maybe there isn't as much of a risk as many people think of a wider war with Russia if we were to engage in a no-fly zone or let the MiGs fly from U.S. bases in Germany, because Russia just doesn't have the military for it. So Putin wouldn't have the stomach for it to then invade Poland if Poland was a launching point for the MiGs or anything like that, and that maybe we overestimate that risk. Briefly, do you have an opinion about that?
I do. It's one thing for Alex and I, as civilians now, to say, well, maybe President Putin wouldn't do that. Maybe he doesn't have the stomach for it. It's one thing for us to say that we think, oh, maybe there's some decent chance that he wouldn't actually start this major war if one of his airplanes was shot down. President Biden doesn't have that luxury, and the NATO leaders don't have that luxury. NATO leaders have to carefully examine whether or not they are willing to go into a situation that could conceivably, and they measure the risks to define conceivably, the risk of a broader war. So I hear a lot of people say, the Russians don't want this. And it's true. They don't want a wider war. They don't want to. They'll lose. They will lose against NATO. In the end, Brian, they will lose against Ukraine. But this is a consequential decision for people who have all the information about the Russians, about the Ukrainians, about NATO and the capabilities. And so I have to believe that President Biden's thought about this carefully.
Right. Your three scenarios for how the war will end that you were talking about last week. One is a negotiated settlement. One is the horrible prospect of Russia taking over the government, Zelensky running a government in exile and a long resistance on the ground in that country. The third one involves Putin being replaced. And let me ask you about a version of that that a listener is asking about. This is a listener tweet. Listener asks, what are the chances of a Putin assassination?
So it's a great question. I think the chances are probably pretty low. I think that the questioner asked the right question about what's going on in Russia. What's going on in Russia is that the situation is getting very bad for Russian families. It's getting bad for Russian economy because of these sanctions. And that's having an effect on the Russian people. And that's got to have an effect overall on the Russian government. It's also getting bad on the Russian military. The Russian military is suffering horribly. The Russian military has lost about 10,000 Russian soldiers. Brian, the Russians lost about 15, 16,000 Russian soldiers in Afghanistan in 10 years, over 10 years. And now they're at 10,000 after a month, after 28 days. So this is a problem for the Russian military. The Russian military is not happy about this, I am sure. They are being exposed for not being very good. So they're not happy about it. The Russian people are not happy about it. The Russian oligarchs who are sanctioned and can't access their money, they can't travel, they're not happy about this. The Russian economy is draining investors. So President Putin has a lot going against him. However, I think it's still a low probability that President Putin will be assassinated. But there are big problems that he faces.
Assassinated or replaced. I've heard it said that this isn't like the Soviet Politburo days where the premier was accountable to, a group of people in a certain respect who were also at the top of the hierarchy. He's really an autocrat now, and there is no equivalent to the Politburo to have a chance of removing him. How much do you agree with that?
Oh, I agree with that. But that doesn't say that the people around him are powerless. That doesn't say that that President Putin doesn't have to worry about anything. He has to worry about a lot, as I just said, and he's got to worry about people around him. I'm sure he's being banged. We see these pictures of how he has meetings, and he's pretty far away from everyone. Just saying that he's got to worry about that as well.
Last question, Ambassador, big picture question and off the topic. You've seen service in many areas of U.S. policy that did not turn out very well. And I'm not saying your fault, but the decisions of the presidents, the policy decisions, didn't always work out that well, and sometimes in big ways. You fought in Vietnam. You served in post-Soviet Afghanistan, which eventually produced Osama bin Laden. You led the first Iraq reconstruction just as the resistance there was gathering strength. You represented the U.S. to Egypt and Libya and Syria during the Arab Spring. All those went bad from a democracy standpoint, and of course the horrific slaughter in Syria. Again, not to blame you for any of it, but are there lessons from the collected failures of U.S. foreign policy that you've witnessed close up that you think should inform the future?
Brian, this is a very good question, and I have given thought to exactly that that list of areas where I and others have served that have not turned out well. And yes, I think the big lesson is one that would have us recognize the importance and the power of the state, the government that we're trying to support, and that we need to listen to, in this case, President Zelensky, but there were others along the lines that knew what was best for their countries. And we, in some cases, came in, thought that we had a better idea, or that we had some suggestions or recommendations for some of these governments that may or may not have gone, may or may not have been applicable to their societies, their culture. And we should recognize that. We should support the values that we do. I have no doubt, I make no apology for supporting the values of democratic governments, of open governments, of a market economy. No question that those are the right things, certainly for the United States. And if those same values and those same mechanisms and those same forms of government are applicable to other governments, and other peoples, which I'm sure they are, it's up to those governments and those peoples to adopt them. And they are best in the best position to decide how to do that. Most people do want to be able to elect their own governments. Most people do want to have a market economy where they can make decisions. Most people do want to be able to have a rule of law rather than the rule of individuals. And they know how to get there. In most cases, they know how to get there. And if we can give any advice on that, we should do it. And if our advice is mainly in the form of our model, of our example, we should do it, which brings up a good point. I mean, people are going to say, yeah, our democracy is not perfect. That's certainly true. And we've seen that recently. It's not perfect. And so we have to have that humility, but we have to believe in ourselves. We have to believe in the values and the efficacy of democracy. And if we believe it, and if we can implement it, then others will follow and they get to decide. That's the big message there, Brian.
Former Ambassador William Taylor, now Vice President for Russia and Europe at the U.S. Institute of Peace. Ambassador, thank you for so much time and for your thoughtfulness today.
Brian, thank you very much for having me.
Brian Lehrer, a Daily Politics podcast, is an excerpt from my live daily radio show, The Brian Lehrer Show, on WNYC Radio, 10 a.m. to noon Eastern Time, if you want to listen live at WNYC.org. Thanks for listening today. Talk to you next time.